Intervju Radija Študent. Amelia Jones, ameriška profesorica na Univerzi v Montrealu, umetnostna zgodovinarka, feministka, kuratorka in avtorica številnih knjig z področja sodobne umetnosti. Med drugim je leta 2002 pri založbi Maska izšla njena monografija Body Art, uprizarjanje subjekta. Je imela v prejšnjem tednu v okviru Mesta žensk predavanje, naslovljeno Koprnenje po prisotnosti, živo telo v umetnosti. Tradicionalna umetnostna zgodovina in estetika, trdi avtorica, se v svojih modernističnih izpeljavah naslanjata na predpostavki umetnika kot božansko navdihnjenega genija in kritika, ki ima privilegiran pogled. Prav body art prakse pa z razkrivanjem telesa razpirajo odnosnost med umetnikom, delom in gledalcem. S tem pa vsadijo seme dvoma o avtentičnosti, prisotnosti in transcendentalnosti umetnosti. Z Jonesovo sem se pogovarjala dan po predavanju. Slednje je vzbudilo nemalo gorečih odzivov posameznikov, ki so zaskrbljeno zahtevali prisotnost, identiteto in glas. Pa naj si je šlo za vprašanje politične akcije, izrekanje zahteve po vidnosti žensk ali vprašanje umetnika kot izvora pomena umetniškega dela. Modernistični koncept sebstva, ki so ga pozna 60-ta, 70-ta in 80-ta prežvečila ter izpljunila, se je tako izkazal za precej trdovratnega.
The responses were very intense and emotional. I mean, in part because a very particular person was there who, you know, relates in a particular way to the work of Marina Abramović. So that is one issue, that Ulay was in the audience. And so that, I'll leave that aside. But the other responses, I think, actually, I was worried at the time because I thought, oh my gosh, they've completely misunderstood what I'm saying. But actually, I felt better about it when I thought, well, no, I think they did misunderstand certain things, I believe. But it also showed you how important this question is, that, you know, there's still a tendency to believe that, you know, we can somehow claim visibility or presence, and that's politically, that's kind of the answer to the problem of being oppressed or marginalized. And of course, I think, you know, as I said to the young woman who was very distressed that I was saying that there is no presence, that we can't, that doesn't make sense, that, you know, we're not even present to ourselves, philosophically speaking. I think there's a generational difference, that I've thought about this for a very long time, and, you know, I understand that desire to claim visibility or to claim a voice or to claim presence in that sense, but I think from experience and from thinking about these issues a lot, that that politically is actually gets you nowhere, and that it's actually a mistake because it depends on a false concept of presence, which involves the idea that we are fully complete within ourselves, that we know what our intentionality is, and that if we just have the public space, you know, to be present, that we can somehow have a political voice and change the world for the better, you know, I mean, to oversimplify. And of course, that's not how power works, and it's not how agency works. And so what concerns me is to make those arguments, to try to to try to explain that isn't, for feminists, for example, to make that claim is actually just bringing this baggage that is actually not feminist, bringing this baggage from modernism that in the end is very damaging for feminism.
And somehow it opens up this essentialistic viewpoint.
Yeah. So the young woman who asked this question, in the end of her question, was very moving, you know, and she said, we need, as women, we need to be able to claim our femaleness or our womanness. I don't remember the word she used, but, and to speak from this position. But of course, what does that mean? I don't know what it means to claim to be a woman, and I don't know what it means for her. I certainly don't know what it means for someone who might have an anatomical female body but might actually think of themselves as masculine, a transgendered person. You know, we don't know what that means. So I keep wanting to ask that question back when someone, you know, wants to be able to say we need to claim womanness. I want to say, well, what does that mean? I mean, because it's different for each person. Therefore, there can be no presence or no essential femininity or no essential position.
This subversive power that body art had in the 60s, it was exactly in that subjectivity is not coherent. It is relational.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason that artists started using their bodies, or one of the reasons, in the 60s was largely, at least directly or indirectly, due to the rights movements and to this need to, either out of this essentialist idea that, you know, women needed to be able to be artists and to speak directly with their bodies, or to create a kind of relational, and it was called relational, people like Ligia Clark actually used the word relationality, to create an open relationship that was an art relationship, because this would then expose the fact that meaning is not inherent in the object, but is actually a relational exchange. So this is a very political thing to do. You know, it came out of this frustration with modernism and all of these claims of presence and of, you know, the inherent meaning and value of the artwork, which of course only I, as the male art critic, can decipher and give value to. So I think it's very important to understand the complexity of that history and what artists were doing, really starting in the 50s, but especially with the rise of feminism and the other rights movements in places like the United States. You know, the artists were using their bodies in public spaces to solicit social relationships, to politicize, I mean, literally politicize art as a relationship. So art is not a thing, it's not a commodity, it's a relationship.
It's a critique of criticism of art.
Yes, very much so.
In what way?
Well, so if we take the United States and you take someone like Clement Greenberg, who it's easy to use as kind of the main example because he was so influential, and by 1960, you know, Clement Greenberg was saying, this, you know, this is art because I say so, and this is the trajectory, the teleology of great modernist art goes from France in the 19th century through, surprise, surprise, you know, the very artists that I'm promoting in New York. So there's your teleology. But at the same time, the sleight of hand is that the empowered critic who represents the institution is acting as if that value is inherent. So, you know, Jackson Pollock as a person is invisible. I'm just telling you, you know, because I can decipher the true value of this drip painting, I can tell you this is a great work of art and it represents the apotheosis of French modernism. But of course, he's a friend of Pollock's, right? So if then the artist directly exposes her body, then the critic has to say, whoa, you know, this body is like right here. So the critic can no longer deny that personal contact or desire may play a role, in fact does play a role in all critical evaluations. So it's immediately, within that context, it's immediately politicized. So this is when Carolee Schneeman, in 1975, an interior scroll, you know, takes her clothes off and pulls a scroll out of her vagina. That is one of the great moments where the woman artist is saying, you know, you cannot escape the relationality of the value that you're claiming to be inherent, that because you're there and you're seeing my naked body, and a woman's naked body has all of this kind of values attached to it in Western culture. So this is what's so important, I think, both in repoliticizing this kind of flat, apolitical language of Nicolas Bourriaud with his idea of relational aesthetics in the 1990s, which the art world loves because it's apolitical and it has no history, and you can just talk about Rikrik Tiruvannija kind of feeding people meals, and but without any of the history of that, which is a rigorously political history, that much of which comes out of the rights movements.
In this history of body art, there are two main focuses, main cuts, maybe Pollock's performative, that is in between modernistic and postmodernistic, and also this cut with feminist theory, where the body art was excluded because they were saying that it's objectifying the woman body.
I mean, I think, yes, there's the feminist, the rise of kind of a, what's often called feminist post-structuralism, or kind of Marxist psychoanalytical feminism, which is very strong in Britain, but also in New York City in the kind of late 1970s into the 80s. And I think there, the legacy there is that the those particular feminists had a lot of anxiety about artists who were using their bodies, because from their point of view, this was essentializing, and therefore it was creating a kind of, or it was recreating a very old tradition of women being associated with their bodies. Now, I emerged kind of at the end of that period as a younger generation person who was quite critical of that feminist prohibition, because for me that was equally problematic to kind of modernism saying that this is, you know, this inherently has this value. So for me, I was trying to say, well, not, you know, you can't argue that any woman who uses her body is necessarily, you know, just repeating fetishism. Like, there has to be a more nuanced way of looking at how that particular work is functioning in that particular context. So I tried to make that more complex and to say that I think it's a more feminist gesture actually to be open to different kinds of production rather than to create more hierarchies and say we're not allowed to talk about this kind of work. That just didn't seem productive to me.
And what about men, men's body? This is also somehow subversive.
I think the men, you know, it's, I would never call Vito Acconci a feminist really, but I think he was, along with people like Paul McCarthy, was really grappling with this heroization of the male body in really interesting ways, and really making that either very funny or very pathetic or very problematic. And they were willing to do that. I mean, it took a certain amount of courage for a man, but on the other hand, of course, he automatically had the authority to do that. So men could question that in a way that wasn't even available to women because they weren't even accepted as artists. So it is a very different dynamic, but I think some of the work by some of the men was amazing, you know, in terms of really interrogating gender and sexuality and these kinds of norms that were attached to male subjectivity. I mean, there's no way you can see a Paul McCarthy performance from the early 70s, you know, and think, oh, he's just another male genius, you know, because everything he's doing is making the male body kind of pathetic and failed.
Can you say that body art is not inherently critical, but it was subversive? We talked about it. Maybe you can explain this relation.
Yeah, I mean, I think a mode of producing culture is only critical in a specific social situation, so in a particular time and place. There's nothing, there is no mode of expression that is inherently critical. Because inherently critical of what? I mean, it depends on what situation it's being expressed in, right? So if we look at the 1960s, we can see the way in which the 1960s and 70s, the very enactment of the body was a profound challenge to that specific moment in Western Europe and North America, because modernism had taken this particular form that was, that required excluding the body or pretending like the body did not play a role in aesthetic judgment. So in that context, it was extremely subversive, most of it, I mean, you know. Whereas, you know, now we live in a different situation. We live in a situation where performance and body art have been around for a long time. There's plenty of, you know, well, I mean, there's plenty of very, very wealthy celebrities who are using performance art to promote their careers. I mean, Lady Gaga or James Franco, you know, Marina Abramovich. These are kind of hybrid people working across the mass media and the art world to promote their careers through a kind of references to body art or explicit body art projects. So is that subversive? No, certainly not. You know, but it might still be interesting in certain ways, but it's not providing that same friction or opposition, because that's impossible.
And maybe where do you see this subversiveness in this moment in time?
Yeah, I don't think we can think of subversiveness in the same way. I mean, I think there was a moment, you know, in the teens and 20s where the notion of the avant-garde was incredibly important, right? Like in a literal political sense, but also artistically. So during World War One, you know, the avant-garde was this incredibly powerful way of thinking opposition to these kind of bourgeois governments that had caused this war to occur. That still had a certain resonance, particularly within American art in the 1950s and 1960s. But, you know, already by Andy Warhol, you had the erosion of this idea of opposition. So you had this idea that he could insinuate himself into celebrity culture, and that could somehow have some kind of interesting effect that wasn't really opposition or subversion, because he's not trying to subvert celebrity culture. He wants to be a part of celebrity culture. He wants to use celebrity culture. So this is a whole different model of thinking about what, I don't know, we might call it progressive practice or whatever claims we might make for that. And I think, of course, now we're 50 years later, you know. I mean, Andy Warhol emerged in the late 50s and early 60s. So, you know, now, what, you know, obviously it's not, you know, there's no way of subverting late capitalism, because it basically will accept whatever you give it, you know, and it will promote it if it's mildly interesting enough. So I think that artists have to have other ways of negotiating the social and the political, and I think now, so this is why the idea of relationality has returned, because now it seems more like opening up that kind of dialogic relationship is more interesting and more productive in terms of making people aware of power, economic disparity, you know, those things that progressives want to think about and make people aware of. So I think there are different models now. I mean, I see artists who are deliberately using different media to obscure their presence, you know, their presence, the idea that somehow we have direct access to them. So Heather Castles or Paul Donald or Susan Sultan, who are very smart about performing live but not allowing you to believe that you have some direct access to them. And I think that's the most interesting work, is showing you how mediated your relationship to them has to be. By definition, it can't be, there is no kind of automatic directness that occurs between human subjects in social space.
And body art in 90s moved to techno subjectivity.
Some of it, yeah. I mean, I think it became this very interesting new way of thinking about feminism, that it could be this kind of hybrid that took account of ethnicity, race, class, modes of embodiment that might even be technologically enhanced. So it's a really fresh way to, you know, move beyond kind of 1970s feminism and this more materialist concept of the body. So I think it was a very important moment. So people like Orlan in Paris is probably one of the great examples of a feminist who was really willing to take that on and actually reshape her body prosthetically through surgeries to question the idea of an essential body. So how can the body be essential if I can actually make it into something else? There are other artists. Lynn Hirschman in San Francisco is an extremely important artist who's not necessarily that well known in certain parts of Europe, but basically has been using variants of new technology ever since the 1970s to continually reshape her identification through this alternative personae, Roberta Brightmore, who, you know, in the 70s is this character that she adopts through her own body, but then she starts allowing other people to be Roberta Brightmore. She also gets legal paperwork to substantiate herself as a legal persona. Then by the 1980s, she starts using robots to kind of robotic cyber Roberta dolls, which have cameras in their eyes, so they get installed in a gallery, and then you could go on Lynn Hirschman's website by the early to mid-90s, and you could actually see through the eyes of Cyber Roberta. And now Roberta Brightmore is an avatar on Second Life, where Lynn Hirschman has her archives. So you have to make the kind of relational commitment to taking on an avatar in Second Life in order to encounter Roberta Brightmore and see this archive. So there are feminists doing really interesting work across these different modes of technology to, again, to move as far away from the idea of an essential presence as possible by these multiple voices.
Maybe for the end, to go back to Marina Abramović, her latest project, The Artist is Present, maybe you can explain why it is problematic. It is encountering this modernistic genius, which is also commercialized, and it is somehow a spectacle. But on the other hand, the viewer has this real experience with Marina Abramović. What do you think about it?
I mean, I've written an extensive article about what I think about The Artist is Present, which was Marina Abramović's exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art. I mean, the problem I have is there's a lot of different issues I have with it, but the Museum of Modern Art is the absolute epicenter of a certain very conservative modernist choreography of the history of art. So first of all, you know, when I was interviewing Marina in, must have been about 2007, 2008, and she told me, oh, it's so exciting, I'm having a show at the Museum of Modern Art. I was like, you know, because I still thought of her as this kind of raw, interesting, risk-taking performance artist from the 1970s. I said, are you joking? Like, are you really going to? And I, as this kind of naive American, I assumed she would realize that this was a complete sellout, you know, and that Museum of Modern Art is viewed as this, like, highly commodified bastion of modernism. But of course, I didn't understand it from her point of view, coming from the former Yugoslavia, that this was like, why wouldn't I do this? You know, this is like the pinnacle of what any artist would ever want to do. So there was a kind of gap between our understanding. But so it's that you have this kind of bastion of modernism which has just decided in, you know, the 2005 that it wants to finally to acknowledge performance and body art. And so, of course, they want the most highly codified, least threatening, most commodifiable, in my opinion, version of performance art. And they have their perfect vehicle provided by Marina, who's basic. I mean, she's literalizing commodity fetishization. She creates this giant, literal giant spectacle. It is an arena lit by Klieg lights with multiple cameras in the epicenter of the epicenter of modernism, which is the atrium in the middle of the Museum of Modern Art, and stages this giant spectacle, paradoxically, of her own presence, which is, of course, philosophically impossible within the situation of the spectacle to have presence. I mean, it's just, you can't, you know, it's so mediated that it completely undermines any claim of presence. And then you have these, you create this media storm, and you have these lines of people, and you have these people crying, and you choreograph this completely artificial emotional intensity, which, you know, remembering 1980s critical discourse as I do, I'm thinking, you know, oh my God, you know, Derrida is rolling over in his grave. And I'm thinking of feminist media theory where, you know, the television melodrama. Now, what makes this any different from a television melodrama that's telling you how to feel? And to my mind, this is very frightening, because we all know the history of the choreography of emotions. You know, it ends up with Leni Riefenstahl. You know, it's I mean, I'm not suggesting Marina Abramović is a fascist, but that is the end point of the commodification of emotions and the marketing of this kind of presence.
But this is somehow more a critique of institution, I understand, that of Marina.
Yes, I'm obviously also politically very concerned about what this means for discourses about art, discourses about performance, and the fact that the art world so immediately wants to forget, you know, 25 years of rigorous theoretical questioning is on the one hand extremely disturbing to me, but on the other hand not surprising at all, because of course the minute they have something new to commodify, that moment where we were allowed to be critical, you know, is forgotten.
Prisotni sta bili Amelia in Alia. Intervju Radija Študent.